just want to make one point that I think you've touched on quite a lot, but just to emphasize it, even when we do get towards that very formal titling system, where we do get all that nice, comfortable stuff on the de jure, we sort of have that default towards.
Yeah.
My experience is that it's, in fact, quite often quite illusory. So you can even get a formal title transfer, an apparent freehold degree of security, but in the de facto sense of, let's say if you're doing an informal settlement upgrade or a post-conflict resettlement, the reality is that the local politics, the socio-political dynamics and elites still manage to actually capture and actually override the apparent security that you've got on paper and in the records. And in fact, the communities usually are left relatively insecure when you measure it against the de jure. So the de facto and the de jure can be quite far apart, even when you think you've got the legal side of it worked out. I just really want to reinforce your point about the reliance on the legal system. It can be very illusory.
It can be mistaken.
Particularly the lawyers can scare you in different directions.
The difficulty I know, talking to shelter providers, is that they still want the document, because you need, you know, it's like, am I building in the right place for the right person? Actually, there was one organisation that didn't wait for any documents. Yeah, it was a real problem, because they built over boundaries. But yeah, I take the point, and it's very hard to know what to do in those cases.
Well, I'm a great de facto person. I don't set too much store by the de jure. It's, once again, it's that donor-driven development, the donor in Geneva, to use your... I think they feel comfortable.
Right.
It's entirely illusory.
Right. So it's just a case of having a level of comfort on the ground that's going to satisfy other people.
Well, if you're on the ground, I think you might have to package things to make Geneva happy.
Right.
To just go away a little bit and then get on and just...
Get on with it.
Thank you for that presentation. I think you captured so many of the important issues around land and security. I'm doing research at the University of Sydney, PhD research looking at resettlement in Cambodia for the railway project.
Right.
Which is co-financed by the Asian Development Bank. So as part of that, I've been more familiar with the formal process of resettling by the development banks, the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank. And you just touched at the end there of your presentation, you mentioned that there might be some role or some transfer of knowledge or at least communication between those two sectors. So the knowledge in the development sector around relocating people or resettlement and environmental and climate change related to resettlement. And I was just wondering if you could expand on that at all, or at least maybe identify some of the aspects that you think might be useful or where the problems are with that. It can't obviously be an immediate transfer of policy.
Look, it's a major issue. The key features of those development based resettlement guidelines are that you do very strong baseline surveys. So there's the socioeconomic survey and then there's the census survey. And the best practice. And in the World Bank guidelines, you've actually got template forms to roll out. And the ADBs adopted pretty much the same. Now, in a disaster context, slow onset or mainly rapid onset, you don't have time for the baseline. And because the principle is that the resettled community should have at least as good conditions, at least as sustainable their livelihoods, etc., as in their pre-displacement location. It's really hard to measure that when you don't have the baseline data, but you can't get it in a rapid onset. I found in what happened in... I worked for UNDP in Aceh. We funded the relocation process because no one would touch it. and there was around 20,000 families that needed new land. When I emailed the World Bank, they refused to actually reply to my email because any mention of the word relocation would trigger the flying squad from DC to come in and trigger those protocols. So it's actually a vicious cycle. It's a catch-22, it were. I'm a big believer in what's happening in the Philippines now is that they're trying to introduce, it's changing day by day, but they're trying to introduce a no-build zone in the aftermath of a major natural disaster. And that's not the right time to do it. I think buffer zones, no-build zones are good ideas. Implement them incrementally outside of an urgent humanitarian context. The typhoon that hit southern Philippines, I'm trying to remember the name of it, a couple of years ago. You know, while they tried to do the same thing, the 40-metre buffer zone, no-build zone on the coast, people were in tents for 2 years because they were stuffing around trying to find new land. My view is it's not the right time to do these sort of things on the run, so that you've got to prepare for what's definitely going to happen. And part of that, I think, is a land audit process where you actually identify potential sites beforehand and you identify communities at risk beforehand, and you've got your surveys and you're ready to go. And then you could maybe adopt a sort of a development type standard. But to do it in the aftermath of a disaster can actually cause more problems than it prevents. That's my
point. Yeah, I think we have to pull the ball there, so thank you very much.